From PRX, this is Living on Earth. I'm Ainsley O'Neill.
And I'm Jenny Doring. Invoking national security, the God Squad waives endangered species protections in the Gulf of Mexico.
These are all species that require protection of the Endangered Species Act to survive and recover. Trump could actually be the first president in history to be responsible for the extinction of a marine mammal.
Also, the Artemis II mission is a key step towards sending humans back to the moon for good.
So this is just, I think, kind of a more comprehensive story that was lacking in Apollo that I think will inspire generations to come of, you know, people looking up into the heavens, knowing that we are an exploratory species on this planet.
We'll have that and more this week on Living on Earth. Stick around. From PRX and the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios at the University of Massachusetts Boston, this is Living on Earth. I'm Ainsley O'Neill.
And I'm Jenny Doring. On March 31st, a panel known as the God Squad, consisting mostly of Trump cabinet members, voted to exempt the oil and gas industry operating in the Gulf of Mexico from the Endangered Species Act, or ESA. The Endangered Species Committee was established by Congress decades ago to evaluate cases where the ESA could pose a threat to the national interest or security. If courts do not intervene, this most recent decision would waive the standard ESA requirements for the oil and gas industry to take steps to protect the endangered species living in the area. One of them is the critically endangered Rice's whale, of which there are only a few dozen left. With me now to discuss is Pat Parento, Emeritus Professor and Senior Fellow for Climate Policy at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Welcome back to Living on Earth.
Thanks a lot, Jenny. Pleasure to be with you.
So, Pat, what exactly is this God Squad, as it's nicknamed?
Yeah, so this is a cabinet-level committee, and it was created in 1978 after the Supreme Court's decision in Tennessee Valley Authority versus Hill, the infamous snail darter case, in which the Supreme Court basically said only Congress can decide how to deal with a situation where the Endangered Species Act is causing a matter of national interest to be blocked. So that's where the term God Squad comes from, because the committee does have the power to waive the requirements of the ESA all the way to the point of allowing a species to go extinct, but only after there has been every effort expended to avoid that outcome. So the exemption process is the last resort where there's truly an irreconcilable conflict between a matter of national interest, sometimes national security, and preservation of an endangered species. That's the background.
Gotcha. Okay. So when you say that this is usually part of a long process, this is the measure of last resort. There's no other options available. Everything else has been exhausted. Pat, I don't think there's been much of a process at all when it comes to this most recent use of the God Squad.
There's been no process at all. None of the steps required in the statute have been met. All that's happened as a result of the meeting of the Endangered Species Committee, that's its formal name, is that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth appeared and said, there's a national security problem here. He wasn't terribly specific. He talked about the fact that there are lawsuits challenging oil and gas development in the Gulf, of which there are, and there will be more. But none of those lawsuits are blocking oil and gas development. None of those lawsuits have resulted in a determination that the Endangered Species Act is actually being violated by anything happening in the Gulf right now. So this idea that you can invoke a national security exemption when there is no threat to national security is not only brand new, it's ridiculous. And I certainly hope that the courts will agree with me and see it that way, but we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
What does this decision to exempt oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico from the Endangered Species Act really mean?
Well, if it was upheld by the courts, it would be a devastating blow to multiple endangered species that are in the Gulf of Mexico. That includes the critically endangered rhesus whale, of which there are only about 51 in the wild, as well as the sperm whale, two species of endangered sea turtles, and the manatee. These are all species that require protection of the Endangered Species Act to survive and recover. Without those protections, the risk of extinction becomes much greater for these species. So that's the real-world consequence of what Trump is trying to do. He could actually be the first president in history to be responsible for the extinction of a marine mammal, the rhesus whale. The science is saying if just one breeding female of that population were to be killed as a result of a vessel strike, that could doom the rhesus whale to extinction. This kind of decision is not only unprecedented, it's wildly irresponsible, because the mechanisms to avoid jeopardy to these species are common sense things. For example, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has determined that to avoid jeopardy to the rhesus whale, boats need to keep a lookout for when whales are in the vicinity and then slow down so you don't run over them. So you see, this is crazy kind of approach to the law. The law is operating very reasonably, just trying to avoid the worst impacts to these species. And along comes Secretary Hegseth and says, I don't care about any of that. I want oil and gas development to proceed without regard to protection of any of these species.
And explain how the Trump administration is using national security to justify this most recent use of the God Squad.
There is a provision in the law for a national security exemption, but the legislative history of the 1978 amendments that created the exemption process makes it clear that that is a very narrow exception, and it is only to be used where there is a direct threat to military readiness and military operations. Hegseth's finding that he presented to the committee on the 31st is that the supply chain for oil has been interrupted because of the war in Iran and the closure of the Straits of Hormuz. But none of that has anything to do with the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act is not threatening oil supplies in the United States at all. It's not even slowing down oil and gas development. There's no outstanding injunction against oil and gas development in the Gulf of Mexico. None. So I don't know what Hegseth is talking about.
So, Pat, what are the broader legal and environmental implications here?
If, God forbid, this exemption were upheld by the courts, all the way up to perhaps the U.S. Supreme Court, this kind of an exemption could apply in all kinds of circumstances. For example, Trump has also said we have a timber emergency in the United States, and he's called upon the Forest Service, which manages 190 million acres of forest land in the country, to use every means at its disposal to increase clear-cutting on national forests. If Hegseth were to come along and declare, like he's just done here with the Gulf, that the timber supply is a vital national interest, a national security interest, and domestic production of timber needs to proceed expeditiously, therefore I'm directing or demanding that the Endangered Species Committee also grant an exemption for timber harvest. You see what I mean? So you can apply this kind of national security rationale to any kind of natural resource extraction affecting endangered species anywhere in the country.
Wow. Pat, can you share a little bit of the backstory about the first God Squad convening nearly 50 years ago and how you helped secure protections for endangered whooping cranes? They're still endangered, but they're doing okay. What do you think we can learn from the past when it comes to navigating ESA exemptions?
Yeah, it's not an either-or choice. It never is. In the case of the whooping crane, what we were able to do there, we brought a lawsuit, we stopped the construction of a massive coal-fired power plant, but then we negotiated an agreement that created a mechanism, it's now called the Crane Trust on the Platte River in Nebraska, which would work actively to conserve the habitat on the Platte River for the whooping crane, and also educate people. Each year, the Crane Trust brings tens of thousands of people to the river to watch the magnificent migration of cranes, sandhill cranes, whooping cranes, and millions, literally, of ducks and geese and migratory waterfowl. What I'm getting at here is there's always an alternative to driving species to extinction, always. It's a choice we have to make. Are we willing to live with some limitations on resource extraction that's threatening the survival of these species? Are we willing to live with that? Or would we prefer a world in which these species keep going extinct one after another? If it weren't for the Endangered Species Act, thousands of species would have gone extinct by now. Literally, the science has documented that. It's a shame, isn't it, that we don't have an administration that sees the world that way. Let's find a way to develop the resources we need without driving species to extinction. We have that ability. We can make that choice if we will.
Pat Parento is a former EPA regional counsel and emeritus professor at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Thanks so much, Pat, as always.
Thanks, Jenny.
Coming up, astronauts are headed back to the moon for the first time in more than 50 years. Keep listening to Living on Earth. Here at Living on Earth, we work hard each and every week to bring you the most relevant and compelling environmental news. As a nonprofit organization, we count on you to help. Listener support is key to sustaining the environmental news gathering and reporting that you rely on. Please consider doing your part to support Living on Earth. A monthly donation is the very best way to ensure LOE's work continues week after week. To make your pledge of support, go to loe.org and click donate. And thank you for helping to keep LOE's nonprofit environmental media going strong.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Jenny Doring.
And I'm Ainsley O'Neill.
And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7, RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1, booster ignition, and liftoff. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
The astronauts of the Artemis II mission are now flying to and from the moon for the first time since Apollo 17 in 1972. It's a 10-day mission, and its role is to test the Orion spacecraft system. There are four astronauts in the crew, including the first person of color, as well as the first woman and first Canadian to travel to the moon. The previous mission, Artemis 1, was an uncrewed flight in 2022, during which an earlier Orion module orbited the moon for nearly a week, collecting crucial data to help prepare for this recent launch. But Artemis 2 has had several years of delays, with some of the most major issues involving engineering investigations into the Orion spacecraft support systems, heat shields, and even fuel leaks. John Daniel Danny Olivas is an American engineer and former NASA astronaut. Olivas has flown on two space shuttle missions, and to kick off our conversation, I asked him about the Artemis delays and what needs to happen to actually get a space mission off the ground.
So a lot of us in the space industry really kind of put personalities on the vehicles that we fly. For example, like all the space shuttles, we refer to them in the female context, you know, Discovery, they're all like, you know, she's, they have their own personalities. And sometimes, you know, you wake up in the morning, you're a little grumpy. And, you know, sometimes, you know, rockets, when they get ready to launch off the pad, they're a little grumpy. And so that's what we saw earlier this year. We saw that the valves are not working the way they were supposed to. We had leaks here and there. And so we just had to take her back into the barn and get those things taken care of. And, you know, fortunately, everything was good enough for her to fly. And the launch was spectacular.
And now Artemis II is the first time we've sent humans back into the moon's space in over 50 years. What are some key differences between our space race of the 60s and 70s and the current state of spaceflight operations?
Wow. How much time do we have? there's a number of things that make our journey to the moon back in the 1960s and early 70s different from what it is today. First off, it's a programmatic and financial thing. NASA gets less than 0.5% of the U.S. budget, and back then we were getting closer to 5%. You know, and even when you adjust for inflation, the equivalent dollar value of Apollo dollars that were going back in the program back then is equivalent to about $225 billion today. NASA does with far less than that, somewhere around 16 or 14, depending on how much they get allocated. The technology itself has advanced and evolved. You know, remember back in the days of Apollo, they were solving equations using slide rules and, you know, basically their noggin and pencil and paper. Now we have, you know, computers and computational technology. We have all sorts of, you know, wonderful instrumentation and sensors. And none of that, by the way, at least for a lunar excursion, has ever been tested and vetted. So it is kind of a brand new game. And then the mission itself, you know, we went to the moon with three astronauts. So we knew how to do that. And this is going to be a crew of four as part of a much more complex architecture than just trying to land the equator of the moon. We're actually ultimately destined for a southern pole landing where we believe that there's water ice. So it's essentially to flying back to the moon, this time to stay, not just to go collect rocks and, you know, beat our adversaries to a technological leap into space.
And how differently do we think about safety in this day and age compared to the last time we went to the moon?
The last time we went to the moon, you know, we did so under the shadow of a horrific accident happening in Apollo 1. And there were some lessons learned there. But as time wore on and we became much more comfortable and mature in the space program, specifically the space shuttle program, we saw what happened when we let our guard down. Challenger was a perfect example of that, and so was Columbia. Artemis is elevated by the astronauts who paved the way before through the hard lessons. And those lessons have not been forgotten. Safety is front of mind for the entire mission. And I like to say that the crew's job is to take care of the mission, but the ground's job is to take care of the crew. And, you know, so long as everybody remembers that and that priority, then we're going to be good to go. There's been a lot of increases in our understanding and our capability. Systems are far more robust and mature, but still, you know, this is the first time, as you said, we haven't done this in 50 years, 50 plus years. So now, you know, this is going to be your first time to do it all over again. And there'll be a lot of lessons that'll be learned. And we'll do everything we can to take care of the crew and ensure that they get the support they need to be able to complete the mission.
I think a lot of us lay people have some understanding of challenges from launch and landing, but what are some of the challenges that the astronauts may face while they're up there in space orbiting the moon?
Well, your food never stays on your plate, for one. No, living and working in space is a challenge. And we've come to, I won't say master it, but we've come to really understand it over the course of the past 30 years that we've had the International Space Station. We've had a human being colony in space on low Earth orbit since the year 2000. And it's been a phenomenal journey. So, you know, we're talking, it'll be 2030 by the time ISS deorbits. And so doing space and living and working in space is something that we have taught ourselves to do. And I think we do it pretty effectively. So a lot of things happen when you're up there, especially when you're doing something like a lunar mission where you've never done that before. So there are systems that are designed to handle the lunar trajectory and the lunar profile. And those are all brand new pieces of equipment. So the mundane things that we don't necessarily think about, like getting water from the galley, you know, cooking in your food, even using the toilet, these kinds of things, as trivial as they might seem, I mean, that's part of the human experience. And you have to get that right. Otherwise, you could end up with just a really, really miserable flight. Then there's the more tactical things that actually carry out the mission, such as, you know, firing thrusters and communicating with the Earth and rendezvousing with vehicles. I mean, all these kinds of things need to be tested out. And the only way you're ever going to get that is by having a human in the loop who can introduce the things that humans do naturally. And that is, there's no computer software, there's no modeling, there's no algorithm, even AI can't get it right. You have to have a belly button in the loop, you know, flipping the switch and pulling the lever.
And now, you, of course, are not just an astronaut, but also an engineer, and you were involved in an independent review team for the Artemis heat shield. What were some of the concerns with that heat shield, and how were those concerns rectified?
Yeah, so the heat shield, when it was originally designed, it's actually, the material is very similar. It's actually almost identical to what was used in the Apollo era. In fact, we as a country, we have been the only country on the planet to have actually bring human beings back from lunar orbit, which is a pretty phenomenal thing. But in doing so, you have to dissipate all the energy that it takes to get there. And that means you're coming in really hot and fast, somewhere in the order of like 25,000 miles an hour. And it exposes the spacecraft to a lot of heat as you re-enter the atmosphere. So this material can exceed, temperatures can exceed 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit exterior. And normally a heat shield is supposed to ablate. You know, think of it here as kind of like it wears away because of the heat. So it's a nice gradual event that occurs. When we flew Artemis 1, we designed this heat shield with this AV coat. We slightly changed the manufacturing process, slightly changed the design. And in doing so, we introduced some variability that caused the heat shield not to wear away, but in fact, it actually cracked and pieces started flying off. And that's a bad thing. NASA doesn't want that. NASA didn't plan for that. So it was a surprise to everybody. Over the course of a couple of years, you know, NASA conducted a very thorough investigation, trying to understand the nature of the cracking of the heat shield to understand why it happened, what the root cause was, and then what they could do to mitigate the effects of cracking heat shield. And then also in the process, they discovered how to make it so it doesn't crack in the future. Now, for Artemis 2, they bounded the problem and were able to fly with the heat shield kind of as is, so that they're going to still experience the same kind of issues. It's still going to crack. However, the time that it cracks and the severity of cracking that could possibly happen will happen later in the entry profile when majority of the heat has already been dissipated. So the crew should be able to come home safely without any issues. So there's lots of supporting evidence to suggest that that's a very good way to approach this. But for Artemis 3, they're changing the design and changing the material so that the material then goes back to wearing away thermally the way it was designed.
And now the Artemis 2 mission is planned for about 10 days, but how long is the actual time spent orbiting the moon? And what kind of science are these astronauts performing during that time?
Well, so from a standpoint of science, think of it as basically the science of exploration. Everything pretty much that's on the agenda for the Artemis crew is really focused on trying to run experiments on what it takes human beings to get to and from the moon. As far as orbiting the moon, well, it's only going to do one lap around it, right? We blast off the planet. Artemis will spend about a day getting into what's referred to as a high elliptical orbit around Earth, and then use gravity to help that in conjunction with a rocket burn to do a translunar injection. And at that point, it will be on a free trajectory flight to the moon. And then once it actually comes into the gravitational forces of the moon, somewhere on the order of around 20,000 miles or so away from the moon, much more closer to the moon than the Earth, the gravitational tug of the moon will pull it towards the moon, but it'll miss the moon because it'll be going so fast that it'll pass right by it. And then it'll pass beyond it. And as the moon passes between Artemis 2 and the Earth, that gravitational tug will pull the capsule back towards the moon, and then ultimately it'll pass the moon on its way back to Earth for a free trajectory. So we basically get the nav Sir Isaac Newton at the helm of the motor for coming back from the moon. We basically use gravity. So that's going to be it. And then it's going to take about 4 days to get there, about 4 days to get back, figure about a day or so kind of first when they first take off. So it'll be a 9+ day, 10-day mission.
Now, overall, we're still in the very early stages of the Artemis program. What do you find so exciting or interesting about the missions that are yet to come?
For me, it's the vision of what lunar exploration could be. You know, back in the days of Apollo, the destination to the moon was the objective. And that was to demonstrate to our adversaries that we had technological prowess and we could actually do something really hard and complex. And we did so. But I don't know that there was necessarily a grand plan afterwards that here's what we're going to do, A, B, C, X, Y, Z. And I think that's one of the reasons why it fell out of favor with Congress and the American public, because there was no evolution from there. We are explorers. We as human beings are explorers. We always look over the horizon to see what's next. And, you know, it's very tantalizing for us to think about a journey to Mars, but in doing so, we know that the journey is perilous. We don't have the propulsion to be able to do that. It would take us anywhere from 7 to 9 months to get there. Typical mission duration would be 2.5 to 3 years. So it could be a really long journey. And what better way to test things out, as we've discovered on ISS, someplace close to home? Well, the moon is a perfect place for that. We know there are resources there. There's water in the southern pole of the moon that could be mined that would allow us to be able to understand how to do in situ resource allocation and utilization, which is what we're going to need to do when we get to Mars, because there are no, you know, hardware stores that we can go buy lumber and all sorts of things that we want to use to build things. So we learn how to use what's there and also try different types of technologies, everything from lunar, well, they refer to them as lunar terrain vehicles, or basically moon buggies, new moon buggies, to potentially even nuclear electricity. So using nuclear power to be able to, you know, keep things warm at night. All these are going to be important technologies that ultimately we would need when we go to a destination like Mars. But in the case of the moon, it's a relatively short trip away. Any problems come up, we can get back quickly. Communication with the Earth is relatively quick. If we go to Mars, you know, you're talking about as much as a 20-minute delay between the time that you discover you have a problem and you ask for help, and it's going to be another 20 minutes before you get the answer back, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are lots of issues associated with exploration. And then, so this is just, I think, kind of the more comprehensive story that was lacking in Apollo that I think will inspire generations to come of people looking up into the heavens, knowing that we are an exploratory species on this planet.
To what extent do you think that this Artemis program is going to renew a public interest in spaceflight, generally speaking?
So, I mean, I'm Mexican-American, and I would be lying if I told you that I'm not excited about seeing the diverse nature of this particular crew. You have Victor, who's a Black astronaut, and Christina is a female astronaut. Reeds is a wonderful commander. You got Jeremy, who's a Canadian. So this tends to cut across a number of different demographic spectrums that we didn't necessarily see before. It didn't preclude us from, didn't preclude me from becoming an astronaut. I mean, I was a child of the Apollo era, and that didn't take away my dream for wanting to become an astronaut. But when we see in society the people that reflect, that we can see that they would share some sort of commonality, some sort of connectivity with who we are and our lived experience, it's exciting to know the kind of generation that this is going to inspire. I mean, we've already seen just a tremendous amount of interest, you know, globally about the Artemis missions that we didn't see necessarily with the Apollo. Apollo was more of a curiosity. Everyone was cheering the U.S. on. But now even the Europeans have stake in the game. The service module is a European contribution to the program. And this is going to provide opportunities for people across the globe to participate in lunar exploration. It's very exciting. And I'm so thrilled that NASA, when it came time to pick the crew, that this was the crew that was picked. And it wasn't because of these attributes, but these attributes being part of the crew make it just an absolutely wonderful crew to be associated with and to know that they're out there representing us.
We are speaking with Danny Olivas, engineer and former NASA astronaut. We'll be right back with more after the break, including the all-hands-on-deck approach to solving problems in space.
My very first space mission, you know, we had a problem with the thermal protection system.
And you might think to yourself, well, who's going to solve that problem for a thermal protection system? You may say, well, maybe it's going to be a thermal analyst or maybe another astronaut, maybe trainers or flight director or flight controllers. And the answer is no. It was actually a medical doctor who solved the problem, came up with a solution.
Stay tuned to Living on Earth.
Support for Living on Earth comes from the Waverly Street Foundation, working to cultivate a healing planet with community-led programs for better food, healthy farmlands, and smarter building, energy, and businesses.
If you're one of Living on Earth's listener supporters, or if you've been considering a donation to LOE, this message is for you. As a nonprofit news organization, listener support is vital to LOE's weekly effort to bring you up-to-date environmental news and information. Your gift to LOE makes a difference and makes our work possible. So thank you.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Jenny Doering.
And I'm Ainsley O'Neill. We're back now with Danny Olivas, an engineer and retired NASA astronaut who flew on two shuttle missions. His journey to space was an achievement decades in the making.
When I was 7 years old, I went on a family vacation to Houston, Texas. And I grew up in El Paso, Texas, even though I was born in California. And I just remember being fascinated by the things I saw in Houston, you know, at the Astrodome, Astroworld, Gulf of Mexico. It was really phenomenal. But when we went to Johnson Space Center, and as I said before, being a child of the Apollo era, going through the museum and seeing all the relics of the Apollo era that were still relevant at that time for me, I mean, it just happened. And so it was then that I was kind of inspired that this is something that I wanted to be part of. I didn't know exactly where or how I was going to be associated with it. You know, I think as a kid, you always, when you think of space, you think of astronauts or you think of spacemen. And so that's the first thing that came to my mind. It stuck. Now, I never really thought that I was going to pursue becoming an astronaut, but it always sat in the back of my mind. When I became an engineer, I just kind of came to the conclusion that, hey, one day these astronauts or these spacemen are going to need someone to work on their rockets. And I can do that. You know, I can turn a wrench. And that's how I used my engineering degree to basically focus on space and my passion for space. And lo and behold, after maybe almost a decade of trying to get in, my application was finally accepted. And 9 years later, I flew my first mission. So from the time I put in my first application to the time I flew my first mission was 19 years. So it was with me for a while.
Gosh, yeah. 19 years is definitely, you had patience is what I'll tell you.
Well, so let's be clear. I think more of it is like perseverance.
Yeah.
You know you want something and you just had to continue working hard every single day, never giving up. And it's so easy just to stop. But the second you stop, then you know that you'll never achieve your dream. But so long as you continue to work towards it, you know, as long as you continue to apply yourself and you're trying to improve yourself, you know, you're still in the game. And that's what I love about space. Even though I'm no longer flying as an astronaut, I still take the lessons that I learned in space and I apply it to everything that I do. And I view every project the way I would as if I was on the moon by myself. It's a science project. And I just try to bring that astronaut way of thinking to the work that I do and the people that I work with.
NASA is at a really, I think, unique position in the public sphere here in the United States. What do you think it is that sort of sets NASA apart in that way?
I think from my perspective and from my experience, it is NASA as an agency's ability to synthesize diverse thought, the inclusion of diverse thought. You know, time and time again, we've seen the value associated in space exploration through that inclusion of diversity. We saw that ushered in the Apollo era. We saw people of all walks of life fly in space and become inspiration to future generations. You know, I don't even say, for example, in even my own mission, you know, on STS-117, my very first space mission, you know, we had a problem with the thermal protection system. And you might think to yourself, well, who's going to solve that problem for a thermal protection system? You may say, well, maybe it's going to be a thermal analyst or maybe another astronaut, maybe trainers or flight directors or flight controllers. And the answer is no. It was actually a medical doctor who solved the problem, came up with a solution.
Oh, wow.
And the reason I think that that's a wonderful story was that when everyone has a common goal in mind and everyone sits at the table and understands what the problems are, they can bring their own unique frame of reference to bear on the solution. You know, I was the one who was actually asked to go outside and fix the space shuttle. But, you know, well, I was happy that Jim Locke, our flight doctor, came up with the solution that he did, was that it was simple. It was elegant. It did the job. I recall the story he told me, and I actually have this really cool photograph. It's kind of the Apollo 13 mission where they throw a bunch of stuff onto a table and say, you know, hey, we got to basically take this square cartridge and fit inside of a round hole type of an event. And Jim was in the corner just kind of watching what was going on, him thinking in his world. And he said, hey, you know, could you guys use a stapler? And they turned around and looked at him and said, we don't have staplers on orbit. He says, yeah, you do. It's in the medical kit. And it turns out that they pulled the stapler out. They tried the material. They tried the technique. They developed a repair solution. And a few days later, they read it up to me on orbit. And I went outside and did it and came home with it. But That experience, you know, all of us kind of pulling together our own skills and expertise to bear on a problem and being open enough and willing to listen to other people who may not necessarily be the leading expert in X, Y, or Z, but man, they could have a solution just sitting right there if we give them an opportunity to bring that forward. And that's what I love about NASA, is that NASA is filled with stories like that. And that's why we've accomplished all the things that we've accomplished. And I think why you look consistently in the federal agencies, NASA is always one of the best places to work, if not the best place to work, because it's a very inclusive environment.
Daniel Levis is an engineer and retired NASA astronaut. Danny, thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
More than 100 people gathered in front of a big screen at the McAuliffe Shepherd Planetarium and Discovery Center in Concord, New Hampshire, to see the giant Artemis rocket light up and fly. And Living on Earth's Steve Curwood was there.
As a big digital clock counted down, ripples of anticipation coursed through this all-age crowd, including one six-year-old who could not stay in his seat. Why was he here?
I came tonight because I haven't seen a rocket launch, and I really like space, and I've never seen a rocket launch. It'd be cool to see one.
A man named Sam also paced around.
It's the core of human beings to be curious, to want to explore, to get to what's next. And this is that first step for our next journey. We're going back to the moon, and we're going to set up a station on the moon, and we will have things going on there where there will be humans occupying the moon as their residence in the future. And that's just, you know, this is the first step for it. And I just think that that's so incredibly exciting.
The McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center honors two famous New Hampshire astronauts. Alan Shepherd was the first American in space and later the first to hit a golf ball on the moon. And while he made it home safely, Concord High School teacher and astronaut Krista McAuliffe did not. The ill-fated Challenger shuttle rocket exploded 73 seconds after liftoff. Both astronauts came from towns presently represented by Democratic Congresswoman Maggie Goodlander.
This is the most extraordinary moment that we could ask for as Americans, coming together to celebrate the end of an incredible process that led us to this night and to all that lies ahead, which is the future, which is innovation, which is space, and all of the discovery that comes with it.
And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
really amazing to watch. It was an incredible experience, and I've been waiting to see this my whole life. So being here has been amazing so far.
University of New Hampshire Astronomy Club member and student Rachel Golobieski.
It's like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We're making history now.
It's felt unreal, out of this world, really. Our generation has never had something like this. So older folks all talk about seeing the first moon landing and how unreal that is. And we finally got something like that. That's feeling, that's adrenaline rush, that's excitement. It's also unreal.
Like Rachel, Riyad Ohabi also studies at UNH and is part of the same club.
Confirm separation. Wow. Main engine.
I asked another astronomy club member, Liam Pearl, to say what he thinks the Artemis moon mission means.
Well, I hope it means that we're going to be able to have a permanent presence off the Earth for good. So, yeah, I hope so, yeah.
So what? Civilization, humanity is never going back. We'll always be more than just on the Earth.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I hope we would go back to Earth, but like not exclusively on the Earth, you know, to avoid extinction and all that.
As the big screen showed the Orion spacecraft going faster and faster to reach 18,000 miles an hour to get into Earth orbit, Rachel touched on the risks ahead on the even higher velocity voyage to the moon. The odds are daunting, knowing that while they took many trips, two of the five operational space shuttles eventually came to fiery and fatal ends.
I think in some ways it's a bit scary, especially for the people and families who are involved with this, but at the same time, there is a lot of risk involved in learning something new, and especially with the past missions, although there have been risks, we wouldn't have been able to make a lot of those discoveries that we have now because of that. So, I mean, I think they've done as much as they can to make sure this is safe, and we're hoping and praying that it will be. And yeah, I mean, I guess all we can do is really learn from our mistakes, and hopefully this one will go well.
And I asked Rachel and the others from the Astronomy Club, including Matthew Anderson and Joey Arena, what they might tell the astronauts right now if they could.
When astronauts are far enough away from Earth and they look back on it, it's almost spiritual how their perspective shifts. And in the modern day, with all of what's been going on, I want to know how their modern perspective changes when they see the Earth, how it is now, in its entirety from their little ship going to the moon.
What would you tell them if you could?
I'd tell them that they're the real-life Fantastic Four. And I hope that they get superpowers out there.
And you, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that their bravery and courage is so admirable. And a lot of people are willing to, I don't know, do some things with, you know, the things that they're passionate about. But nobody is really willing to die for what they're passionate about. And obviously, we hope that's not the case. But the fact that they're putting their lives out there and, you know, really just committing their life to this, I think, is an incredible quality that we all should have for whatever we're passionate about and courageous about.
UNH astronomy students and others speaking with Living on Earth Steve Kerwood from the Artemis II launch party at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center in Concord, New Hampshire.
Last month, we brought you the stories of pioneering female scientists, from Marie Curie to Vera Rubin, Mamie Phipps Clark to Saolan Wu. But before any of those women made their names in the scientific world, they were young girls whose interests and passions for science would lead them down their life's path. A few years back, I joined up with a similar group of young, passionate scientists called the Boston BioBlitz Initiative for Girls. A BioBlitz is a citizen science competition where people rush to document nature in their own communities. While the team that collects the most data does get bragging rights for the year, the real winner is the scientific community, which is able to use that data for research. So I caught a ferry out to the Boston Harbor Islands National Recreation Area with this group of teenage girls as they practice their citizen science skills. It's an overcast spring day, but our group of girls is still excited to be heading out to explore the island habitat. There are 10 of us on board a small ferry boat, 5 teenagers from different Boston public schools, and their educators from Zoo New England, Brandeis University, and the National Park Service. On the island, the spring thaw and rain mean plenty of mud. Fortunately, our guide for the day, Luke Thorson from Thompson Island Outward Bound, has planned ahead.
We have some tools that we're going to give you that's going to help you explore today, help you feel comfortable going out, getting your feet not wet, but your boots wet.
This field site on Thompson Island is maintained by the program Outward Bound and frequently hosts Boston Public School students. Luke directs us to a shed where we change into knee-high waders.
It is early in the season, so we're going to have to do some looking and get down and get dirty and see where things are, meet them where they're at.
Luke passes out some field guides, and we hit the trail down to the salt marsh.
How'd you pass?
Oh, I think
it's very nice. It was just a black bug that just, it like popped. It's not like a big one.
As we walk, we spot some bugs and some birds. And we're hoping to see hermit crabs, oysters, fish maybe. But before we even get to the marsh, the girls find something unexpected. Mark Albert from the Park Service, Colleen Hitchcock from Brandeis, and Luke help them identify it.
Ooh, howdy.
Scat.
Yeah.
Look at that scat, guys.
You'll see that? Someone should photograph
Who's
that.
Who's going to iNat that?
Yeah, someone should iNat that.
You want me to take a picture?
Yeah, take a picture of it.
All right, so remember with iNaturalist, we not only can document things that are alive, we can document things that are dead, and we can document evidence of species. And so taking a picture of this scat is a great thing to add.
The girls take a picture and upload it to an online database using an app called iNaturalist, where experts will help identify whatever's in the photo.
And I know this is poop, but it's mostly hair of animals, so I'm going to touch it with the sticks. I'm just trying to show that there's bones in here, which will make it clear that it's
probably not a dog.
Coyote.
Bone in the poopy?
Bone in the poopy. Look at the photo she was able to take using the magnifying lens.
Really cool.
Oh. Bone in the poopy?
Bone in the poopy.
Whoa, this is bone in the poopy.
So you have coyotes on the island.
We do.
That's so interesting.
They appeared here just a few years ago, just a male and female adult that came over. So we have a land bridge that opens up at low tide. So they made their way over, and then they had pups. So they had pups here, and so now we have a family, a grown-up family that lives somewhere around here. They stay pretty much to themselves.
When we arrive at the marsh, it's a flurry of activity to get out nets and petri dishes and to grab the smartphones and tablets we'll use to document the species. Within minutes, the girls are sifting through water to find plankton, bugs, and perhaps the most hoped-for critter, hermit crabs.
Oh, hermit crab!
Ah! Success! He's like hiding. Should we go and do it on iNaturalist?
Yes. We definitely have to iNat that.
Yay! Yay!
He's like popping in and out. Nice job, Kendra.
He's okay.
Let's put a little tiny bit of water in there.
Are you going to hold it?
Do you want to hold it?
Definitely should hold it because you'll be
really
tiny. Let's see how many hermit crabs we can collect and see if we can find the biggest one.
When we wrap up at the marsh, the sun comes out and we head to the beach to look for native and invasive oysters.
We want to go down as low as possible into the low tide area because oysters live underwater basically. Yeah. So they don't want to be up here where it's only covered during the high tides. But you can start to see oyster shells already. These are dead oysters that they're now just the shells wash up higher. But we ideally want to find some live oysters.
The oyster data that's collected from the City Nature Challenge will help researchers trying to determine the current ratio of native to invasive oysters in the region. The BioBlitz team marks off an area and identifies as many oysters as they can find in that space.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Actually, we found the other species.
Oh!
So look at this. So if you open this up, see that purple thumbprint in there? That's an indicator that this is actually the native eastern oyster.
Wow! That's cool.
And so they very strongly attach to rocks, so that's not surprising that we're seeing this one attached to rocks. But you see, if you look inside these other ones, they don't have that same telltale sort of purple thumbprint.
Wait, so these are the native ones?
So these two are the native ones.
Eventually, the team finds 26 of the invasive oysters and just two of the native ones. As Thompson Island fades in the distance, I asked the girls what they liked best.
I think the salt marshes, because that's where we saw the most life. And it was really fun, like, with the boots and, like, in the water and finding all those hermit crabs and everything.
Well, I also really like the salt marshes because we got to, like, I never really paid that close of attention, like, to how much life there was. And I really like just getting muddy and just exploring.
And to document the life they've seen, the girls log on to iNaturalist. With heads down, huddled around our phones, we must look quite the sight. Windswept, muddy, slightly sunburnt, and appreciating nature in our own new-fashioned way. The 2026 City Nature Challenge kicks off with the BioBlitz from April 24th through April 27th. So if you're looking to hone your skills beforehand, you can learn more at the Living on Earth website, loe.org. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Naomi Ehrenberg, Paloma Beltran, Sophie Boker, Swayam Gagneja, Mark Kausch, Mark Seth Lender, Don Lyman, Ashanti McLean, Nana Muhammad, Sophia Pandelitis, Jake Rigo, Andrew Skerritt, Bella Smith, Julia Vaz, Elle Wilson, and Hedy Yang.
Tom Tiger engineered our show. Allison Lierstein composed our themes. You can hear us anytime at loe.org, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube Music, and like us, please, on our Facebook page, Living on Earth. Find us on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Living on Earth Radio. And we always welcome your feedback at comments@loe.org. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. I'm Jenny Doring.
And I'm Ainsley O'Neill. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from you, our listeners, and from the University of Massachusetts Boston, in association with its School for the Environment, developing the next generation of environmental leaders, and from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration in solving the world's most pressing environmental problems.